This is the supplementary review for exam 4 for Philosophy 205, Contemporary Moral Issues. What's the difference? And we're starting with animal rights, issue 15. What's the difference between a vegetarian and a vegan? A vegetarian may eat some animal products but not eat meat, and a vegan eats no animal products whatsoever. So a lacto-ovo vegetarian will consume dairy products and eggs. A pure vegan will not consume dairy products or eggs or wear leather and eschews animal products altogether. What sort of diet did human beings evolve to eat? Well, human beings are omnivores. We evolved to eat both meat and vegetables. You can tell that because even though we have front incisors, which are meant for ripping and tearing, and we have residual canine teeth, and you can see in earlier forms of man that those are more pronounced, particularly the canine teeth. And our ancestors look a bit more like gorillas. Like our closest ancestors, the great apes, we also have these flat grinding teeth in the back used to grind vegetables. So we are not an herbivore. We're not carnivores, we are omnivores. Herbivores eat only plant foods. Carnivores eat only meat. And in a carnivore, you'll see a very short digestive tract, more sharp tearing teeth and fangs. Omnivores, again, evolved to eat a variety of foods. Now, that doesn't mean that you must eat meat to survive. It just means that that's the sort of diet that human beings evolved to eat, which is a combination of both meat and plant-based foods. Are there any health risks associated with eating meat, particularly the amount of meat in a typical American diet? Yes, definitely. So eating meat is good if you want to have quick energy, densely packed energy, and live to say your mid-50s. And after about that time, nature really doesn't care about you and care whether you live or die. So you could keel over of a heart attack or die of cancer. If you have lived through your prime reproductive years, nature thinks, aha, I've done my job, I have spawned, and now I can die and the next generation can take over. If you want to live a long, healthy life into your late 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, be like Ray Bradbury, who died at the ripe old age of 91, eating a lot of meat is not a good strategy. Meat is full of saturated fat, it has no fiber, the excess protein puts a strain on your digestive tract, and if you look at the amount of meat eaten in the Paleolithic diet, it was actually not as great as today, because you had to hunt that meat. And you had to hunt it with crude traps, stone tools, flint spears. And so if you're thinking about the difficulty involved in hunting game animals in a low-tech culture, it's not as if you can just go through the drive-thru at McDonald's and order as many burgers as you want, and they're all 99 cents. So even the Paleolithic diet before agriculture, when human beings were hunter-gatherers, they still ate a large amount of plant-based diets. They ate roots like yams and potatoes. They ate lots of berries and greens. They just didn't have grains make up a large portion of their diet. And during the winter months, of course, meat was in short supply. So this is why the typical health of the vegetarian or vegan compared to the typical meat eater is much better, with vegans coming out on top, vegetarians coming in next, and the meat eaters coming in last. And people who eat large amounts of meat. The more meat you eat, the worse off you are. And particularly people who eat cured meat, which would be things like bacon or pepperoni or sausage, which has nitrates in them, which is a carcinogen. It's what we use to preserve cured meat. And also, those who eat a lot of meat also predispose themselves to cancer. You get clogged arteries as a result of the heavy saturated fat. You get osteoporosis because the excess protein acidifies your blood, and your body is looking for some way to balance that out to maintain a proper pH level. And it says, oh, look, here's some calcium. I can leach that out of the bones and balance out this dangerous acidic imbalance. There are the only nutritional deficit you have without eating meat is vitamin B12. So there are some things which are a little harder to get, vitamin D, but you know, in the modern scientific age, there's products fortified with vitamin D. And you know, even the meat eater, you know, drinks vitamin D fortified milk. Well, there's vitamin D fortified soy milk or coconut milk or rice milk. And it's pretty difficult to be deficient in vitamin D if you get plenty of sunlight. Now, if you're living in northern latitudes, which human beings, you know, didn't evolve human beings evolved in the equatorial region. In the African continent. And so if you are living in northern latitudes, which is sort of an unnatural place, you're going to have to take a supplement or be extra sure to eat vitamin D fortified products if you're a vegetarian. And then, you know, the vitamin B12, which actually is not a component of meat, but vitamin B12 is a bacteria that exists in the gut, and again, there are supplements for that. So that's actually not something found inherently in meat. It's a bacteria that comes from an animal grazing in a place where it poops. And it turns out we need just trace amounts of it, but it is an essential nutrient. So vitamin B12 is the only thing that's missing, and it's actually not part of the meat itself. And some people think that you can get all the vitamin B12 you need if you just use organic, organic fertilizer, i.e., you know, animal droppings as fertilizer, as many people do. Manure is the word I'm looking for. So if you fertilize your crops with manure, you're probably going to be okay. And there are myths about, you know, not enough iron. And again, if you eat lots of green leafy vegetables, there's lots of iron there. And there are other vegetable products which have lots of iron in them. And even lots of protein. So if you eat a wide variety of foods, beans, peas, rice, legumes, you're going to get complete proteins and you'll get plenty of protein. Vegetarian or vegan diet also helps people maintain a normal body weight because plant food tends to be less calorie dense. Plant foods have all sorts of anti-cancer substances. So to the degree you're supplementing those replacing those with meat, you're not getting those healthy substances. So, you know, the dark colors in the green leafy vegetables, the blues and reds and in berries and fruits, those are all very important in staving off cancer. Fiber is also important for digestive health, and plant foods also are helpful in maintaining a good immune system. And there are all sorts of things in plant foods that we know that people who consume lots of them have lower incidences of various diseases across the board. And sometimes we're actually not sure how it works or why it works. We just know that it works. And we can also see that people who eat copious amounts of meat have much higher incidences of disease. They've done studies on Seventh-day Adventists, many of whom are vegetarians, and again, the vegetarians always come out on top as being healthier overall. The animals you buy in the supermarket, the animal products, those come from factory farms. In order to generate the amount of meat present in the typical American diet, it's necessary to treat animals as an industrial commodity. And that means if you're going to produce that much meat, you're going to have to pack them in small little cages and corral them in a barn, and the way they're treated, just like a factory commodity. They are packed together in their own excrement. They don't get sunlight, and are treated in various kinds of inhumane ways. And this is all demonstrated in the whimsical video, The Meatrix. Are there any arguments against eating free-range animals which are treated humanely? And there, the question is it only the suffering that matters, or is it the killing, too? If you're killing and exploiting animals for human taste buds, is that something which is morally okay? So if you think that as long as you treat the animal humanely, it has a nice life, it's able to roam around and graze and live at least as well as it would in nature, then you might think you haven't done anything wrong if you painlessly kill it and consume it. But some would argue that it's the killing and exploitation of animals that is also something which is morally wrong. If you worry about the environment, meat eating is consumes a vast amount of resources. It takes about 10 times the amount of resources to farm a pound of animal food compared to a pound of vegetable food. Most of the agriculture in the United States is to grow grain in order to feed cattle, in order to fulfill the insatiable American appetite for meat. And so it consumes a lot of water, you get a lot of pollution in streams and in rivers, and so it is a major environmental concern. What is the alien analogy? So that's in one of the handouts, and it's just what if a race of aliens who are an order smarter than us, which is as far away from they're as high. Try this again. What if an alien race was more advanced than us in the same way that we're more advanced than the animals we eat? So they are to us as we are to cows and pigs and chickens and so on. Would it be okay for them to kill us and eat us? Or could they just treat us any way they liked because they were superior? That seems to be an implausible might makes right idea. It seems that what's relevant is not really intelligence, per se, but it's the capacity to suffer. And just as we have the capacity to suffer, so do animals. The pet analogy is that many of the animals we eat for food have the same level of consciousness and awareness of the world and the same rich emotional life as the animals we keep as pets and wouldn't dream of eating. And so in the U.S., dogs and horses are seen as sort of sacred animals. People keep them as pets treat them with affection and love. And yet, if you look at, say, a pig has the same level of intelligence, the same sociability, and the same qualities that a dog has. And about the same level of intelligence, but we eat the pig and don't eat the dog. People are aghast at this idea of eating horses. But again, what's the difference between a dog and a horse? A horse may not even be as have the same level of awareness as a dog. So the argument is, if you would eat a dog, why would you eat a pig? And if you think if you don't like Michael Vick, who was convicted of dog fighting, of putting animals in cruel situations for human amusement as sport, why would you approve of animals being corralled in tight little pens for years and suffering day in and day out just to please human taste buds and provide meat at a price that people are willing to pay? So you could go away from factory farms, but the price for meat would be much greater because you wouldn't be able to produce as much supply in a humane way. Someday we may be able to farm meat, or I should say produce meat, in a vat using bacteria and genetic engineering, but we're a ways away from that now. Speciesism is a unjustified prejudice towards members of another species, similar to racism and sexism. What are some arguments presented in Peter Singer's article, All Animals Are Equal? And there, I guess I'll just ask about, you know, on the exam about the moral principle of equal consideration of interests. And it's not as if Singer says that animals should have rights in the same sense that humans should have rights, that you should have the right to vote or the right to drive an automobile or something like that. It's just that animals have a right not to suffer. So an animal should have its interests considered based on the kind of being it is. And so any being capable of feeling pain has an interest not to feel pain. But since an animal isn't capable of, you know, voting or serving on a jury, then consideration of those interests don't apply because the animals don't have those interests. Some arguments for eating meat in Ralston Holmes. He makes this separation between nature and culture. And he says, eating animals is part of nature. It's part of human ecology. We evolved to eat meat, and so it's completely natural. But when it comes to harming other human beings, that's a matter of culture. And that's where morality comes in. So he thinks about morality as being culturally defined. And because eating animals is part of nature, he doesn't consider that to be part of the sphere of morality. He also argues that animals suffer in nature, and so it's too high a burden to say, oh, we can't allow animals that we farm for food to suffer at all. It's just that we have to make sure that we don't inflict gratuitous suffering on them. So that he says that means just making sure they don't suffer any more than they would in nature. So in nature they suffer, you know, food deprivation and extremes of heat and cold and so on. So he says if you weigh the suffering of the animal in human care, and it's at least somewhat better than they would experience out in the wild, then it's morally okay. And as an example of gratuitous suffering, he gives various religious methods of butchering animals, which he thinks are good examples of inflicting unnecessary suffering on animals. On the argument that it's natural to eat meat, therefore it's morally okay, again, in class I mentioned a lot of things which are natural to human beings. It's natural when someone insults you to want to punch them in the face. But, you know, civilized people don't do that. It's natural if you have power to use it to exploit others. It's natural if you're a strong man and there's a defenseless woman that you find attractive and you want to have sex with her. It's natural if she says no to not take no for an answer. Now, but it's morally wrong to not take no for an answer. So there are a lot of things which come naturally to human beings, being lazy, being selfish, and being callous to the suffering of others. And it's only our socialization and our moral principles which keep those baser impulses in check. So this idea that something, that just because something is a natural proclivity, therefore it's morally okay, is seems like an example of the naturalistic fallacy. One might also say that fearing or disdaining those who are different from us is natural. And so, you know, the reason why racism still persists, why tribalism still persists, why people engage in regional sporting events, and it's our people against their people, it's territories ritually battling it out on a football field. Why is that? Well, it's this natural human tribalism. Is that, you know, necessarily a good thing? Is it a good thing to treat the outsider in a way different than you treat a local? And you think about that attitude of you ain't around from here, boy, are you? You know, that sort of provincial harassing of the out of towners. That's part of human nature. But people who live in a civilized society practice hospitality of the stranger and the foreigner, and see racism and sexism and the other various isms that plague us as being something that civilization should attempt to stamp out. So just because something, again, is natural may even be a part of our evolution, doesn't mean that it's good or it's conducive to human welfare and happiness. There's this argument that animals eat each other, therefore it's okay for us to eat them. And that doesn't seem to follow. You know, animals don't have free will. They're doing what they do by nature. And that might just be the system we're stuck with. But it doesn't mean that human beings have to participate in that. They have a choice as to whether or not they're going to inflict suffering on animals in order to serve their taste buds or not. And the other thing you might say is that, you could still eat meat, but what if you had to kill your own food? I think that, I'm sure there are some hunters in the class, but I think that if each person had to go out and actually hunt their own food, people would eat a lot less meat. There's an argument in class we talked about that animals are incapable of giving moral consideration or making moral judgments, therefore we are obligated to treat them in a moral fashion. And that doesn't seem to be true. There are human beings who are mentally disabled and incapable of making moral judgments, people in sanitariums, people with severe mental retardation, and we don't think we could treat them any way we want. We don't think we could hunt them for sport or eat them, right? So just because you're incapable of making a moral judgment doesn't mean that you don't have to be treated with moral consideration. The death penalty. What sorts of crimes can one receive the death penalty for? It has to be murder, and has to have a special circumstance. So torturing the victim, killing someone during the commission of another serious crime, multiple homicide, killing a police officer, that sort of thing. So not every murder receives the death penalty. What sorts of people receive it more often, according to Welch? Minorities and the poor. How might death penalty actually increase the number of murders rather than deterring it, deter them, according to Welch? And Welch argues that the death penalty makes people more bloodthirsty. It causes people to devalue life because the idea is that life doesn't matter because the state takes it away. So he thinks that having the death penalty as a punishment actually makes people more callous to the value of human life. What sorts of death penalty recipients does Welch find especially troubling? And that's the youth and the mentally disabled. And he gives some examples of those sorts of people, teenagers being executed and people with brain damage and, you know, extremely low IQs who didn't really have the capacity to appreciate the quality of their actions being executed as well. How is it alleged that politics play a role in who is executed? And that has to do with, you know, when did you commit the murder? What state did you commit it in? If you committed the murder in Texas, good luck. You're probably going to be executed if there's any special circumstance involved, even a sort of a minor one. If you committed a crime in a state without the death penalty, then, you know, you're going to get life in prison. There's some states that have it on the books, but generally don't execute people. And there's also, you know, various kinds of appeals. And so the appeals will vary from state to state. Texas has very few appeals, and people go through the appeals process pretty fast. Other states, you can drag it out for decades. Also, it depends on whether the local, you know, prosecutor or district attorney or attorney general is running for office, or the governor. So if you can have an opportunity to commute the sentence to life in prison. If you have a tough election, you don't want to look soft on crime, and so you may not commute that sentence and just let it be carried out. Is there any evidence the death penalty is a deterrent to murder? And there isn't, because and von den Haag points out that as currently practiced, the death penalty doesn't there's no good evidence that it is a deterrent, because for something to be a good deterrent, punishment has to be swift, severe, and certain. And so if punishment is not swift, severe, and certain, then it doesn't have that deterrent effect. And also, what might make it a deterrent? Well, yeah. Have the execution right close to the trial, limit the number of appeals, you know, have a streamlined appeal process, so make it swift, make it certain, so make sure it's more uniformly applied, and that, you know, when people commit a murder under these circumstances, that, you know, they'll definitely get the death penalty, and with severity, I suppose, is built into the punishment. And then also make them public. So if you had public executions and people and executions weren't carried out in secret, people are actually able to see an execution. That makes it more real to them. It's the same reason they show, you know, starving kids with flies buzzing around their heads and their ribs sticking out when they want you to donate to a charity for alleviating third world poverty, for example. Right? Why do they show you that? Well, it's because it affects your emotions, and it motivates you. And they show those images because they work in the same way. So that's the sort of an enticement to do something. In the same way, if you show a person being punished in a very public way and say, here's a guy who committed this crime and here's what's happening to him, that's going to function as a deterrent. Currently, only family members and members of the press are allowed to observe. Pictures aren't allowed, and so when it's done in secret, people read about it in the paper, but it's not as real to you as if you actually saw pictures or video footage. What does von den Haag mean when he says unequal justice is better than equal justice? Unequal justice is some people who deserve the death penalty getting it, and other people not, because of their race or because they've got more money and can afford a better lawyer. And he says it's better that at least some people get the death penalty who deserve it than that nobody gets it. And he thinks this idea that it has to be equally applied or you have to get rid of it is absurd. And he gives the analogy with speeding tickets. He says it may be true, and studies show this, that people who drive fancy red sports cars get tickets more often than people who drive other kinds of cars. Does that mean you should stop handing out tickets? No, handing out tickets is is something which keeps people driving at a safe and prudent speed. Just because some people get more tickets than others, that doesn't mean you should stop giving out tickets altogether. Similarly, he gives another analogy about trucks. The trucks example is meant to respond to this question, well, what if you execute an innocent person? And he says, look, when you drive trucks around, you increase the amount and severity of accidents. But trucks have a useful function in society, and so just because they're dangerous doesn't mean that you don't use them if their benefit outweighs their liability. And he thinks that's the case with the death penalty. See, there's this a religious opposition that it degrades human dignity or violates the sanctity of life. And there he says that you're supporting the sanctity of life by executing the murderer. You show disregard for human life if you protect the murderer from paying the ultimate penalty for his crime and give him a punishment which is not fitting of the crime of taking a human life. What's wrong with the arguments against religious conservatives that the death penalty is a violation of the biblical sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill? Well, the death penalty shows up all over the place in the Old Testament, and there's a couple of places in the New Testament where it seems to be endorsed for a civil government. The Apostle Paul says Caesar does not bear the sword in vain, which is a reference to execution and law enforcement. And also he says to obey the powers that be. And Rome had the death penalty. Rome executed Jesus. So thou shalt not kill is better translated thou shalt not murder. So that commandment has to do with premeditated murder. And if you read on in the book of Exodus where that appears, you'll see that it makes a distinction between manslaughter and premeditated murder, and it mandates killing in war. It mandates execution for adultery, for working on Saturday, and a whole host of other crimes. So that's a misinterpretation of that verse there. And also, we have separation of church and state in the U.S. And there's no, it's written into our Constitution that there shall be no religious test for public office. We have a secular state with, a sort of a ceremonial deism, but we have a secular government, and what's written in the Bible is not relevant to what punishment a person ought to get from the civil government. Why doesn't death penalty violate the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, according to Vanhoef? And that's the fact that at the time the Constitution was written, in context, cruel and unusual punishment would be something like drawing and quartering a person, or boiling them in oil. So there are all sorts of harsh methods of torture and execution that were practiced at the time, and that's what the founding fathers had in mind, not just simple execution. And the Constitution also says that you shall not be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. Well, what do you call it when you deprive someone of their life? That's an execution. So execution is assumed to be an acceptable form of punishment for certain crimes. Bagarik and Clark say that there is this torture. Bagarik and Clark say their ticking time bomb scenario is, even if it is fantastic or unrealistic, it helps you appreciate the morals considerations and hone in on what it is about torture which may make it justified or unjustified. So it helps us hone our moral intuitions. They also argue that a situation like this could really happen. And you had a case like this with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who had information which led to the foiling of actual plots to blow up the Sears Tower. It helped us catch Abu Zubaydah and other terrorists. And so, you know, there has been actionable intelligence which has been used to thwart actual crimes from these enhanced interrogation techniques used in Guantanamo Bay. So those five variables are just in the text. I'm not going to mention those, or you can just look them up there. And they're just, you know, a few of them are like the, is there sort of an imminent threat? How likely is the person to have the information you need? You know, do you have sort of leisurely amount of time to get the information for other methods, or do you need it right now? What would be what's the magnitude of the imminent threat? Is it a nuclear bomb's going to go off? And so you weigh all these various factors to see whether or not it makes sense. The legal status of torture, it's, you know, banned by international treaty. And so it's illegal by international law. Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the reason why people are taken there, because it's sort of like a murky legal situation, because it's not within the borders of the U.S. And so a person there is not subject to U.S. law and doesn't have the rights accorded them by U.S. law. How widespread is the use, according to Bogaric and Clark? And they say that it's not, you know, it's used widely, you know, in other countries. In the U.S., not so much. And they say that torture ought to be treated like illegal drugs. Recognize that, you know, the CIA and other military officials are going to use torture. Either you should regulate and control it and limit it strictly, or you just drive it underground, and people are going to torture anyway, and they're going to do it in more horrific ways, and just not tell you about it. So Devine says, under a number of different moral theories, that torture is wrong. He says if you look at conventionalism, sort of look at what does the international community say, what does human society say about torture, and it's generally takes a pretty dim view of it. And sees it as morally wrong. It's banned by international treaty. And he says if you look at the Kantian view in terms of you know, human rights and responsibilities, that it's seen as absolutely morally wrong. And he says if you look at the utilitarian view, which is another major moral view, which says that morality is all about the consequences of your action. He says there's all sorts of utilitarian reasons why torture is bad. It doesn't produce reliable information. It gives your enemy a reason to fight hard and not surrender. And he points out that one of the reasons why you had we had Iraqi soldiers surrendering in the first Gulf War is because they thought they would get good treatment by the Americans. There's also the very real possibility of blowback of if it comes out that you have the American reputation besmirched, and that might, and you might even encourage more people to take up the cause of terrorism, as they are morally outraged by the treatment that their fellow citizens have gotten at the hands of American interrogators. A waterboarding is a technique where you simulate drowning. You lay a person on their back on a table, you put a cloth over their face, and you pour water down over the cloth. And it becomes very difficult to breathe, and the person has a feeling that they're drowning when they actually aren't. It doesn't leave any it doesn't leave any physical marks or disabilities, but it's psychologically traumatic and very effective at getting people to talk. And this is, you know, finally what broke Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the mastermind of 9/11. And afterwards, after, you know, a series of waterboarding sessions, finally after he was broken, He, you know, sang like a bird and would even actually give classes on how terrorists do their dirty work to interrogators. One last thing on torture. You know, is torture an effective means of getting information? Yes. And this is something that's, you know, empirically and intuitively verified. If, as a child, if you ever were a part of an altercation or witnessed it, where one person was bending back the arm of another person and telling to you know, assert the superiority of the first person, or cry uncle, or, you know, do something, you know, that, torture works. People are averse to pain, and if the pain is intense and certain, and there's a way to get away from the pain, people will do it, particularly if it's an intense and fearful kind of pain. So if bending back, you know, another kid's arm and it didn't make him cry uncle is enough to get him to do something, then certainly a waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques done over a long period of time with no possibility of escape would be effective in eliciting information. Now, what if the person lies to you? Well, you can ask the person questions that you have means of verifying and test his truthfulness. So there are ways of cross-checking information. So it's not as if you take whatever the person says as valid and act on it. There are ways of cross-checking. And we've gotten actionable intelligence from terrorists that we've used enhanced interrogation techniques in Guantanamo Bay on. And you know, what are enhanced interrogation techniques? Well, they're, you know, subjecting people to extremes of heat and cold, depriving them of sleep, giving them a diet of sort of a rationed diet, of making them drink Ensure instead of giving them actual foods. You're not starving anyone, you're not beating anyone, but you're putting them in an uncomfortable position. And the waterboarding is probably the most extreme technique that we've used and officially sanctioned, and that, you know, that's led to important intelligence and actually has led to the capture of the killing, not the capture of Osama bin Laden. And you know, some people have suggested that perhaps the reason President Obama wanted bin Laden killed as opposed to capture is because it would put him in this dilemma. If we had captured bin Laden and had subjected him to these enhanced interrogation techniques, we would have gotten a treasure trove of information. But President Obama campaigned on being against torture and being against enhanced interrogation techniques. He promised to close Guantanamo Bay, which he, and then later, you know, backpedaled on it. So he's already in hot water on that issue, and so he didn't want to put himself in deeper trouble and have Eric Holder, you know, try bin Laden in New York City, as he, you know, attempted with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and then had to back off on. So without these enhanced interrogation techniques, without torture, even, you know, a kinder and gentler form of torture, bin Laden would still be out there, you know, planning his next terrorist attack. Okay, so that's the review. Good luck on the exam. If you have any questions, send me a Moodle message.